You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on November 10th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the U.S. midterm election results, the Tunisian parliamentary election results, and the coup in Burkina Faso. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio, as usual, is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Okay, so over the course of 2014, I would say, we've more or less ignored everything that's been going on with the U.S. elections, partly because I just wasn't that interested in doing like horse race stuff back and forth all the time, but also just because it's a lot easier for us with radio station rules and everything to not talk about the election. But the election's over now, so we can talk about it, and there's lots to talk about. Obviously, the headline being that the Democrats lost control of the Senate, but there's certainly a lot more to discuss there and specific angles and other things that happen in the same election. Let's get started, though. Bottom line, pretty much as projected, not a great night for the Democrats on the Senate front. A couple races still left to be decided, but the Senate has definitely gone to Republican control come January at this point. Pretty hefty losses, even on ones that were probably going to be lost, but maybe they thought they were going to be closer. A few that were, looked like they were going toward the Democrats and then didn't. And then, of course, out of basically nowhere, Mark Warner's reelection race in Virginia that he almost lost. That ended up being, I think, 0.6% of the vote margin instead of the projected closer to 10-point margin that had been forecast. And back in January of 2014, 11 months ago or whatever, he was polling as high as like 29 points ahead and stuff like that. So something seems to have gone wrong in that, I think partly on the polling. There's been a lot of analysis, by the folks at 538.com and all that about how, and this was stuff they were bringing up before the election, that there seems to be a trend of pollsters kind of looking at each other's polling and polling averages and then tinkering with their models and results and like weightings, especially because that's where you can really manipulate the results even after you've done the calls, is to adjust how much you weight each particular group for your turnout model. And they're sort of making them match each other so that nobody stands out like, the nail that gets pounded down as the outlier, when in fact some of them might have had better results if they hadn't messed around with that. And, it would have been seen as an outlier, but it would have actually been correct because the averages were wrong. On average, the Senate polling was off biased in favor of the Democrats relative to the actual outcome. I think that's probably a more convincing explanation than saying that there was some huge wave on election night that like was not forecast or anything. I don't think that particularly happened. I don't think there was necessarily people staying home in droves that had been planning to vote. I think that the polling was just kind of wonky, and that tends to happen. There have been a couple relatively good cycles recently, but before that, there's been a lot of polling error. And, another thing that Nate Silver and folks like that had brought up was just that the error tends to underestimate the home state advantage, basically, of whichever party is dominant in that state. So if it's like, Massachusetts, it underestimated the Democratic turnout for the Senate race. And, right. That in Arkansas, it underestimated the turnout for the, Republican Senate, the Republicans in the Senate race. And it just, that tends to skew, for each state, but there happen to be more states that were sort of Republican leaning this year on the ballot that were competitive. Nate, what was your take on this Senate outcome? And also, I guess, the fact that Republicans managed to pick up even more seats in the House. I think it's at least 10 so far, and still some being counted.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty bad result for the Democrats, and pretty solid just across the board pickups for Republicans, especially on the state level. I think I read something that was a record amount of Republican control at the state level across the 50 states, at least in terms of governorships and things like that. So I think it's safe to be said that they're going to have a lot of control over policy in the next upcoming years, you know, whether it's bills in the Senate and House or at the state level. But one thing I would like to focus on is their agenda. And that's something I didn't hear a ton about actually during the election. It just sort of like seemed like everyone was running on like nebulous Obama tiredness and like just sort of a general dissatisfaction with the administration and Democrats in Congress. So, and then just sort of attacking them on more narrow focused votes or, you know, aspects of their personal life or something like that. So what's me interesting going forward is to see what the Republicans actually do once they get in power. Because we saw this, you know, back in the last midterms, right? We had the Republicans, you know, win the House and, you know, make various advances, you know, sort of in states, and ends up with a lot of their initiatives don't, you know, A, they don't succeed. Part of that is because they have, you know, only one control or one House in control. But at the same time, a lot of their priorities, whether it's repealing Obamacare or various anti-abortion legislation, and it just seemed to not present a positive agenda moving forward, but rather sort of just they were attempting to chip away at whatever Obama had accomplished, or just sort of having a relatively extreme agenda they were putting forward. So, and this was across all states as well as on the federal level. So, and I think that really helped turn people and help Obama get reelected back in 2012, just because there was a bit of a reaction against that. So what I'm interested in these next coming years to see what the Republicans actually try to do from a policy perspective, and see how that either, you know, see whether they overreach again and potentially that leads to some more support for Democrats in the next election cycle, or whether they sort of capture, you know, a bit of the public's trust and, you know, the public might start believing in some of these policy ideas if they come to fruition and can be shown to help people. So, you know, in that case, it could be even harder for Democrats in the next election cycle. So we really need to see, you know, how extreme they're going to be, how, you know, proactive they're going to be in pushing their legislation forward, or if they're just sort of going to be continue to just try to frustrate Obama and, you know, cause problems for Democrats without actually putting forward like a real, just a sort of a vision of American policy going forward.
Now, Nate, you've been talking about the sort of lack of a Republican agenda going into this election. Let's talk about the Democrats' agenda, if they had any. My position, and I don't know if you agree with this, is that the Democrats effectively who are running this year did not have an agenda. I mean, this is a trend that's been developing for a long time, but this seemed to be sort of the ne plus ultra year of that happening, where there was no agenda whatsoever. Nobody was running on anything consistent across state lines. It was all personality based. It was all, well, even if you don't like Obama, you should like me for this reason.
Yeah,
like,
there was a lot of that. And we actually, I want to put forward one example that it wasn't even like, and this is a little relevant from the point you just made about like Democrats trying to pretend that they weren't necessarily 100% lockstep with Obama, but just an example of politicians sort of crafting their ads to create a certain message. And it was Richard Tesei, who was running here in Massachusetts, I think in the maybe the 6th district, maybe in the North Shore or something.
Yeah, it's the North Shore one and up by Essex.
Yeah, and so, you know, Richard Tesei, I think, is a gay Republican, and in his ads, that was a pretty prominent feature. Like, he starts off with saying, like, my husband and I, and then blah, 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 and then sort of went into it like that.
And rather than only came out 4 years ago.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, that's a decent point. I'd forgotten about that. So, but instead of maybe having just, like, a picture of his family at the end of the commercial, you know, he was really going out there and, you know, putting himself forward as a gay, well, actually, I wouldn't even say Republican, because it was actually pretty nebulous which party you actually belonged to when you looked at his ads, because he kept talking about how he'd be independent and, you know, would just be. And so I'm thinking, like, oh, is this guy a conservative Democrat, or is he, you know, quasi-liberal Republican? Like, what's going on here? And then obviously, you know, figure out who Richard Tesei is. And it just, that's an example of just sort of trying to target your ad towards an audience, especially here in Massachusetts. We see Republicans all the time trying to appear to be maybe more moderate than Either they actually are, or they might run in a different state. So just
and that didn't really work out for him. And it seemed like Democrats were trying to copy that in reverse in a lot of states. I mean, you had Mark Pryor trying to run as the most Republican Democrat in the Senate, which in Arkansas, and it's like, well, good job with that. You voted against all the like major proposals put forth by your own party. What's the point of you? And as I think probably somebody like Marcos Melitzis or something like that said, you know, when you run as the most Republican Democrat, usually people just go for the authentic thing and pick the Republican instead. And, you know, I think that's a fair point. Another one that there was a lot of criticism, especially by people like Zaid Jilani writing in Al Jazeera America, saying essentially that Michelle Nunn's campaign in Georgia, she's a daughter of a well-known and well-liked former senator there, and she lost by quite a big margin after running a campaign that included no mention of poverty, no mention of income inequality, no mention of all the problems facing, you know, Georgia, just talking about how, you know, it was time to work, you know, in a bipartisan manner, work with the other side and don't vote for my opponent because he's too, a little too extreme and we got to be nice and moderate and centrist and everything. And we got to support the Keystone XL pipeline in North Dakota or wherever. Like, it had nothing to do with Georgia, despite, you know, all these problems that are facing Georgia's, you know, economy and the average people there. And, you know, I mean, to bang this drum that I've been banging for a while, come on, Democrats, like, what's the point? It's not like, you know, you don't all turn into radical Marxists or something by running on a platform that is specifically catered to the lower middle class or the working class or whatever. Like, why are you trying to run a campaign that's explicitly geared toward the upper middle class, which numerically, yeah, they vote a lot, but they're still not like most of the electorate. There's a lot of people in Georgia who didn't even bother to vote or aren't registered to vote who would probably vote Democrat, but they're, you know, why do they have an incentive to sign up and register to vote for this Democrat who's not even going to run on anything relevant to them? You know, this is the problem. We keep seeing this again and again, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or something else, where somebody comes along and says, hey, I'm actually going to run on a thing and really enthusiastically do it. And it's not extremist. It's still very moderate and reasonable. But, you know, you run on that the platforms that are relevant to the majority of people. The majority of people provide you the votes to get into office. You know, they're just running on themselves or running on, oh, I'm not Obama or whatever. And they won't run on actual economic populism. Economic populism is seen as like a dirty word, but it's like, well, we don't all have to be Nazis or something to be economic populists. Like there's a huge...
I don't even think the Nazis were all that economically populist, so...
Well, but they were trying to push those populist buttons and
right,
you know...
But there's a difference between pushing populist buttons and actually pursuing, like, an economic policy that was, like, for the workers.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? Is that there's this perception in the United States...
Well, Nazis are actually liberal. I don't know if you heard that. No joke, I had a friend that, like, kind of seriously believed that for a little while. Like, he read the Jonah Goldberg book, Liberal Fascism, and, like... I had an argument with him, like, at the beginning of our friendship, like, this guy's a complete moron, because, like, he just bought, like, the conservative or more libertarian lines, hook, line, sinker, eventually managed to convince him otherwise. But, I mean, it's just such a juvenile argument, too. It's like, oh, well, liberals like government, and so did the Nazis, so there you go. Boom. Hillary Clinton, basically Hitler. Or Hermann Göring or someone like, you know, just a bad person in general.
So this is the perception that we've got somehow established in the United States, and I think it's definitely fueled by this sort of Goldman Sachs arm of the Democratic Party, where the decision was that we'll go after that money base, but in order to do that, we have to pitch, like, you know, that these parties are identical, essentially, and that you can't lose whichever one you support, so you might as well support the Democrats. The only argument is basically, oh, well, the Republicans are extreme and they're too out of step on social issues. But other than that, we're exactly the same as them. And that's not
convincing.
Well,
the problem with that is, yeah, I mean, if they're exactly the same, then the Republicans are going to give you more money because they don't like taxes. And, I mean, as economically corporatist as the Democrats have been in recent years, I don't think they've too often, like, campaigned with their main focus, like, let's get rid of taxes. So if your decision is between two relatively similar parties, or at least how they present themselves, and maybe you don't care about social issues all that much, and you want lower taxes, easy to vote for Republicans. I mean, it's just not a great message when they're that similar portrayed in the media, or at least, you know, the Democrats are really pursuing these stuff that's basically in lockstep with Republican ideas about business to the point where... And I'm not sure what the money was like coming in from iBanks and stuff during this election cycle, but we saw last time, Goldman, all those guys were supporting Obama in 08, supported Romney. Why would they support Obama? I mean, it wasn't even like Obama was particularly hard on banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis. You could easily say he could have done more, but they still went to Romney the next year anyway, because they know Romney would be easier on them. I mean, that's not even a question.
He's one of them.
That is who Romney is. He lives in that world. He's part of that bubble, and he's also part of another bubble, which is Mormonism, but we won't really get too far into that, but there is a bubble there. And when you combine those two things, the idea that Romney was fit to be elected president of the United States was one of the most absurd campaigns I think I've ever remembered seeing, you know, in my relatively short experience following presidential campaigns, because it was so bad, and they're talking about run again. So bad. I would like to see it one more time. Okay. Him and Rand Paul duking out in the primaries and then taking on Hillary or whoever. That's going to be entertaining.
All right. Well, before we wrap up this segment, one final point that I really want to get into here a little bit. So as folks may recall, right after the 2008 election, there was the Mitch McConnell speech that was, I forget if it was public or leaked or what, but anyway, word got out either way that he said that his caucus's number one priority in the Senate was to make Obama a one-term president. So they had basically lost by this huge landslide election in the Electoral College, one of the biggest margins in decades for a president running for, you know, a first term or whatever. Certainly the biggest margin for Democrats in, you know, since at least Carter in 76, if not further back. And their reaction to this was stonewall everything. And that was like a very concerted policy. This week we have these, I felt, absurd statements from congressional Republicans, especially on the Senate side. They met with President Obama in a very tense and hostile lunch, saying, you know, don't do anything with executive orders. Don't do anything on immigration. Don't do anything less. Whatever you do, if you do something, it's going to poison the well and there will be no chance of working with us for the next 2 years. And then they went and said to the media, you know, it seems like he doesn't even recognize that he's just lost this election and that his policies have been rejected all across the country. That was like a John Cornyn quote. He's the Senate whip, I believe, for the, you know, incoming majority. The disjunction between this poison the well argument made by Speaker Boehner and, you know, similar ones made by the Senate Republicans compared with their own reaction to losing in 2008.
Seems like more blathering the Republicans have been doing just after these elections. I mean, they can say everything they want, but until the Republicans actually start pursuing, you know, what seems like relatively common sense policies to the majority of Americans and don't get fixated and bogged down in these, like, culture war battles, which I think they're, by the way, I think they're incapable of doing that. I don't think they can avoid getting distracted by culture war issues, because that's pretty much a foundational part of the Republican Party. I mean, that's sort of the glue that holds things together in a lot of ways. So, I mean, I think they're almost certainly going to be pursuing these things in the future. So, I mean, we'll just have to see what happens, but
all right, well, stick around with Arsenal for Democracy. Coming up, we've got coverage of Tunisia and Burkina Faso. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment with more. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the election results in Tunisia. We've had a lot of doom and gloom coverage of various so-called Arab Spring countries. Tunisia still, so far, is the real bright spot. They've definitely had their challenges, but nothing approaching the scale of any of the other countries. They just held their first official elections under the new constitution. They had had a transitional election before that was basically specifically elected for a 2-year period with the goal of assembling, having an interim government that could run stuff and also to prepare a new constitution. That lasted for, I think, about a year, or year and a half or so, and then had to step down in favor of a caretaker government, kind of technocrats and all that, while they finished hammering out the constitution, because there was concerns about, you know, whether there was going to be some sort of a coup or whether the ruling Islamist party was going to be too repressive or something like that. Anyway, the results of these elections was that the explicitly anti-Islamist party, Nida Tunis, won the most number of seats. That Islamist party, Ennahda, the moderate ones. They're still, I think, in like second place. They probably will not be in a coalition together. That seems pretty unlikely based on statements we've been seeing in the news. But this is, you know, a pivotal moment that they didn't just have elections, but that the results were recognized. Because we saw that Libya had its elections at the beginning of this year. And they, you know, the transitional Islamist government there lost power in those elections and did not accept the results. And we'll get back to that in a moment. But you've also been, you know, if you've been listening to our previous episodes, you kind of know what happened in Libya after that. Whereas everyone pretty much accepted the results here. I mean, some people are maybe not happy about it, but that's, we're not happy about the Republicans winning in the U.S., so, but, you know, we're not going to go declare war. So this is a good sign, right? I think that they've been able to make this transition. And of course, it's, you know, we've got to probably get to another election and have another handoff before we can be confident about this process. But this is definitely a very positive sign, I would say.
Yeah, actually, funny you mentioned about the two-step process or having several elections. I was just reading an article by University of Syracuse political science professor contrasting the democratic transitions in Tunisia versus Turkey right now, just sort of contrasting the rise of democracy in Tunisia versus sort of increased authoritarianism and sort of the decline of the democratic process a little bit in Turkey. I quote Samuel Huntington talking about, you know, several different transitions. And as you're rolling your eyes, Bill, that's immediately what I was doing there as well, because, I mean, Samuel Huntington has written a lot of, let's say, racist and fraudulent things in the past. But regardless, it seemed like it was a decent example. You know, you need to have a couple different transitions just to make sure that, you know, it's not a... Because haven't we seen a lot of these examples in the past couple of years of, okay, a Democratic Party gets in power and it's allegedly in control, but then, you know, you sort of see encroachments from whether it's the military, whether it's the president, you know, acting in a way that is just certainly contrary to the democratic process. And you see these states sort of backslide a little bit towards a more authoritarian system and sort of not really fulfilling the promise of the Arab Spring. But I think Tunisia, and it has been for a little while now, has been like pretty much the success story of this. And this is, of course, where everything started, too. So, you know, it is positive to see that they talked about how they, you know, when they set up the constitution and it was voted on, I think, last January or this past January.
Yeah, January or February of this year.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it instilled a lot of the power in the parliament. When with a more parliamentary democracy type model rather than a presidential type model, which I think is probably good at this stage. You know, it seems like Tunisia, it's, you know, the state institutions are relatively strong. Like, it's not completely falling apart like Libya. And, you know, if you can get a decent couple parties in there and they're actually working, you know, positive fashion to, you know, have a balance of religion and secularism in the country and, you know, have modern laws. And, you know, Tunisia, I was just talking with you off the air that I think there's opportunities for a lot of tourism there, and you wouldn't want to necessarily block off some of that by having like extreme, you know, Islamist laws. So, you know, it seems like they're moving in the right direction right now. And that's really positive to see, especially when we see, you know, the tremendous problems that Egypt, for example, has been going through over the past couple of years, or, you know, even in Libya, there's a lot of problems there as well. So I think it's a good step in the right direction.
Right. One of the things that Tunisia really seems to have going for it, based on some of the articles I read, like there was some, I think an Economist article, for example, on the upcoming presidential election in Tunisia. They have a sort of semi-presidential system, but like Nate said, the parliament's going to be a real big force here. Tunisia had single party rule after its transition. Basically, France released it from the colonial system. There was a monarchy set up for about a year, and then the monarchy was overthrown by the sort of founding father of the independent Tunisia, who, you know, is usually referred to as Bourguiba, I think. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. But he, you know, ruled Tunisia until 1987 when Ben Ali took power. And he ruled it, you know, in an authoritarian single party manner, but sort of in the same vein as like Ataturk in Turkey, where there was a lot of modernizations and reforms happening. But some of the sort of really positive reforms that he made in terms of strengthening Tunisia's potential now is that he created a strong civil service that is sort of, you know, independent, nonpartisan, can continue the functions of the state regardless of what's happening, you know, on the party side. It's not tied into a specific party. And perhaps most importantly, compared to every other regime, you know, non-monarchical regime in the Middle East and North Africa, he said that the military's role was either to be in the barracks or to be on the borders. Pretty simple. Now, Tunisia does have a problem with a sort of large autonomous police force that created a bit of a police state. That was one of the prompting factors behind the Arab Spring starting in December 2010 in Tunisia. And that has remained a bit of a challenge, and they're going to have to continue trying to rein in the police's role. But he was so concerned, I think justifiably in retrospect, with the idea that there would be a military coup that would remove him from power, that he basically turned the military into what the military probably should be in most countries, which is either an external force or a border defense force, right? That they're not supposed to be deployed in the streets, you know, and wandering around and whatever. They did provide some amount of security for the recent elections, but that has remained true, that the military is basically a non-factor for the most part. We're not predicting, you know, a Libya-style attempted overthrow or a Egyptian military coup. That's not really on the radar in Tunisia because of that decision that's been undertaken. So in that front, and then with some of the sort of social reforms, you know, education and women's rights that had been pushed back in the, you know, 1960s, you know, people are saying, okay, well, maybe this is going to be the good old days coming back to power, because this is essentially the party of people that were sort of aligned with that old order. But it's a question, is it old order or is it old guard? Because the guy who's the party leader of Nida Tunis, that just is expected to take power and lead the coalition, he's 87 years old,
right.
Beji Caid Sebsi, and he was the sort of transitional prime minister between the fall of Ben Ali and when they held the transitional elections for that interim government, I believe. And he is, you know, in addition to being old as heck, is just like really associated with that old regime.
Yeah, he actually also was the interior minister in the 60s for the, you know, the president before Ben Ali. I'm trying to pronounce it. You just did it a second ago.
Bourguiba.
And apparently there was a lot of repression of dissent back then. So it's hard to think that Sebsi was not involved in that. I think he is a figure that could potentially provide a bit of transitional stability and sort of get this democratic process up and running, because, I mean, I don't think he would be the long-term president or leader of that party either, considering he's 87.
I mean, I'm concerned about what happens when he dies.
Right, and I think the issue now is they need to start developing a technocratic class, a political class of people that, you know, will be there for the years to come. So it's not just this one guy and like, okay, he dies and then we're going to go back to chaos. It's, okay, Sebsi is the president for a while, you know, sort of we build up these institutions and develop, you know, a group of people that could potentially lead this country going forward in a democratic way. So the different parties have to develop different, you know, there has to be sort of inter-party battles to determine like the agendas and who's going to lead them going forward. So, you know, I think if this, like these next couple of years for Tunisia, similar to how the last couple of years have been, if they start just on a sort of a slow build up, I mean, you hope that, you know, within 5 years, it could be close to a functioning democracy. Now, I'm not saying that's not one right now, but, you know, with all the institutions necessary to be a lasting one. So I'm hopeful, you know, obviously the process is nowhere near completed.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the downsides, though, in addition to his age, I think a lot of people think that the police are very close to him and his people personally.
Right.
And
yeah,
they've continued
interior
those,
ministry,
yeah, so. The, you know, extrajudicial killings and all of that have not necessarily stopped, although I think they've been reduced somewhat. And then there's the concern that he wants to remove provisions that were sort of truth and reconciliation style provisions that were implemented during the transition, that essentially the idea of that would be that if you committed a crime in the 1960s or whatever, you know, on behalf of the government during their repressive phase, and he was, again, the interior minister during that, so he probably committed some of those or ordered them, that, you know, you might not be immune from prosecution, that there might be some sort of procedure for at minimum bringing this to public light and potentially going beyond that truth and reconciliation model and having actual prosecutions. And he doesn't want that to be retroactive. So I think that's a concerning element.
Like unacceptable that it was retroactive. And it's like, well, I mean, yeah, he probably would think that considering, you know, some of the stuff he might have gotten up to back in the 60s. So, I mean, whenever you're talking about these sort of truth and reconciliation processes in democracies that are, you know, emerging after periods of brutal repression, I mean, there are still going to be guys around that were involved in this. So that makes it an extremely difficult issue. And it is a little disheartening to see that, you know, he's not exactly pressing for full transparency and full reckoning of what happened in the past, considering it probably involves him.
Yeah, I think probably the route they're going to have to go is sort of a middle ground of saying that these abuses can be brought to light and discussed, but that there's not necessarily going to be prosecutions because it was so long ago, you know, and that's not ideal, but that at least allows you to like just move forward at that point and keep going. So this is, I think, great in comparison to Libya, where not only do you have these rival governments there of the sort of transitional people who refuse to leave power from the Islamist side, but also these secular people who won this year's election. And then that was just invalidated by the Supreme Court, actually, because they moved the parliament to Tobruk, which is a topic that's come up on the show before. That's basically a city way over in eastern Libya near the Egyptian border. And that was done for security reasons, I think quite reasonably. But apparently the Libyan constitution says that the parliament can only meet in Tripoli, the capital, or Benghazi, the second city, which is the eastern core there. So the Supreme Court in Tripoli, theoretically not under the control of the Islamist militias that have taken control of the capital. But, you know, there are questions about whether or not their integrity has been compromised, perhaps. Issuing a ruling without explanation that most people believe is probably based on that provision, the geographic provision, just saying, oh, well, now there's no constitutional government. And I think that that's, you know, not great because it's just complete chaos at this point on the sort of legal side, even regardless of the actual security situation outside. So that's another way that Tunisia is doing a lot better. One area that Tunisia is not doing so great on is regarding the sort of extremism situation. There was a New York Times article right before the election where the senior leadership of Ennahda, the moderate Islamist party, acknowledged some pretty serious missteps that they felt that they had made and were going to try to correct whether or not they won re-election, which is essentially that Tunisia had this paradox created where the problems that sparked the Arab Spring weren't being solved by the reforms, so the conditions weren't changing that made people angry in the first place, but that the relaxation of the authoritarian policies of the regime did mean that it was now easier to recruit for extremist causes. So the anger is still there, but it's now easier to recruit for extremism. Now, for the moment, fortunately for Tunisia, this has been sort of an externalized problem. Essentially, the recruits are not being directed against the Tunisian state or government or parties for the most part. It's actually being sent to Libya and to Syria primarily. Tunisia has long been, because of the previous repressive regime, and continues to be one of the biggest sources of recruits for Islamic extremist causes in other parts of the world, not in Tunisia. They basically say, well, there's no point for me here, and I would, you know, I'd rather have a hard life, you know, fighting on alongside the Islamic State or whatever than have a hard life with no prospects in Tunisia. And I think that ISIS is in particular a really compelling draw because it's promising, we will cut you regular paychecks. You will not be unemployed. We will get, you know, we will find you a wife. We will find you a place to live. We're going to, it's property redistribution. It's wealth redistribution. It's all of these sort of ultra economic populist agendas that really appeal to these disaffected young men from places like Tunisia and even appeals to some of the sort of senior people. Like they've had Tunisian telecoms experts and stuff like that going over to work for the so-called Islamic State to set up their infrastructure so they have a physical like cell phone network and everything. I mean, this is tapping into something very fundamental that has not been addressed. And I think Ennahda is saying they're going to try to crack down harder, you know, within their own base and that kind of thing of making sure that extremist recruiting is not happening and making sure that people have another path to turn to. But for the moment, that's not what we're seeing in Tunisia.
Yeah, and this is something we've talked about for feels like years now when you're thinking about the charity work and various things that Hamas and Hezbollah do to gain roots in the community and gain support amongst the people that are, you know, experiencing extreme economic hardship. That's a way that they can get people to buy in to this, you know, sort of Islamic lifestyle where, you know, it's not just praying, it's also fighting against whoever, you know, you need to fight against at that certain time. So it just, there are ways that, you know, and we talk about soft power sometimes. This is soft power. Like, you know, it is economically based, so, you know, blah, 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 you can say that. But the fact that, you know, as you said, they're cutting paychecks, they're giving work, and this is obviously, you know, the entire Middle East has very high rates of unemployment amongst the youth. So, you know, if they might be inclined that way already and they can get an easy paycheck, I mean, it's a frightening prospect, really, especially when you're talking about, you know, telecoms execs setting up cell phone services and, like, Wi-Fi and stuff for ISIS, 3G LTE networks.
Right. Now, you know, obviously, Tunisia can only be applied so far because it's got that outlier of not having that military role, for example. It's also, you know, it's 11 million people, approximately just under 11 million people in a relatively small geographic area. Contrast that with, you know, 6.2 million Libyans over a pretty vast area, even just along the coastline. That's a pretty long distance. Or the 87.5 million people in Egypt. There are definite limits to how much you can cross apply this. But I think that for the moment, Tunisia is still headed in the right direction and is setting a very positive example. We're going to take a quick break now, and then we're going to talk about the so-called Black Spring, the complement to the Arab Spring that may or may not be starting in Burkina Faso. A lot of people looking to the Tunisian example in the past few weeks because of some pretty obvious parallels between the two countries, both of which were formerly part of the French colonial system. So stick around, and we're going to talk about the situation in Burkina Faso, why that's so important, and why it might not actually mean much for the rest of Africa. Stick around. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphreys. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're talking now about the coup d'etat in Burkina Faso that happened a couple weeks ago now, about a week and a half ago when we're putting this on the air. And essentially the situation there, a little bit reminiscent of the situation in Tunisia several years ago, is that Blaise Compaoré, the president of Burkina Faso since about, I think, October 1987, just literally within weeks of when Ben Ali came to power in Tunisia, was forced to resign through a series of rapidly escalating protests. Now, Burkina Faso has had a long history of various, you know, military coups and street protests and things like that. They're, you know, definitely hooked into that really French vibe of taking to the streets when there's a problem. But I would say they took it to a whole new level Thursday of that week when the members of these street protests walked into the capital and said, you know what, there's supposed to be a vote today on removing term limits in the parliament. They're going to amend the constitution. They can't do that if there's no parliament building, so they burned it to the ground.
Well, to be fair, the French have destroyed their government several times after following street protests. I don't know if they've necessarily burned anything down, but, you know, stormed the Bastille and, you know, barricades on the streets. And so let's give a little credit to the French.
Fair point, fair point. So, you know, the interesting thing about Blaise Compaoré, he's a former military guy, you know, staged his own very violent coup notoriously in 1987. The unusual thing is that, so Burkina Faso is now on coup number 7 of their entire history, but unlike...
Is that like a bonus multiplier or something once you reach 7, or does that wait till 10?
Yeah, you get the 10th one for free. The effective situation here is that there has been no military coup since the end of the Cold War. He took power in 1987 before the Cold War. A lot of other countries in West Africa or other parts of Africa have continued to have military coups, and we'll get into that in a second of just some of the recent ones. But he has somehow managed to, despite having one of the poorest, least developed countries in the world, where 90% of the people still work in subsistence agriculture, meaning they do not make more money from agriculture than they need to support themselves financially. They just have enough to live on. You know, Burkina Faso, seems like it would have been ripe for even more coups. It seems like they should have been having them like every 2 or 3 years just from the dysfunction and dissatisfaction. Instead, this guy has managed to preserve stability for 27 years. And the craziest thing about this is that he was never popular to begin with. Most of these guys who last a really long time at least have that, like, you know, 5, 10, maybe even 15 year phase where they're super popular and can get away with anything. And that's how they stay in power, because they use that goodwill to, like, you know, pass all these radical reforms or keep themselves in power or shore up their control. And instead, he came in as one of the most hated figures in all of West Africa because he overthrew the revolutionary Marxist-affiliated government of Thomas Sankara, which was, you know, not particularly Soviet-aligned per se, but had come to power in 1983 with a pretty basic plan that said, we're going to create schools all over the country. We're going to create health clinics all over the country. We're going to mass vaccinate the population. We're going to do all these really basic steps to improve the quality of life for our people. And this was a real inspiration for a lot of folks all across West Africa. Thomas Sankara is still considered a hero by most people, not just in Burkina Faso, but all over the region, even in the non-French-speaking countries. Okay? And Blaise Compaoré, who had organized the coup that brought Sankara into power in the first place, then overthrows him in 1987. Sankara is killed in mysterious circumstances when the presidential palace is stormed, and this guy comes in as basically West Africa's villain in chief. Okay, and yet somehow manages to basically play everyone off of everyone else for 27 years until his time just completely ran out and he had to step down the day after the parliament was burned on that Friday and go with French help, go across the border to Cote d'Ivoire to escape, essentially. And, you know, he kind of said, made some statement like, well, I guess it was time to go. And, you know, I don't think that my time was up, but the people said otherwise, so I'm gone. I mean, and I hope it works out for the best.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously the major factor here was that the military, which had sort of mutinied during the same Arab Spring period when there was thoughts that maybe they could copy the situation in Tunisia, they had been kind of, you know, brought back on board temporarily, but this time they just mostly stood on the sidelines. There were a few fatalities in some of the clashes, but for the most part, they stood on the sidelines. And then there was, Compaoré referred to this as a constitutional vacuum, which I thought was a bizarre phrase until I looked really deep into this and figured out that, yeah, there actually was a complete vacuum of power, because the way that the constitution was written as amended in 2012 was essentially that if he resigned, the president of the Senate was supposed to become the acting president, except that they had forgotten to set up the Senate. So there was no Senate and therefore no president of the Senate to take power. So he just resigned and said, well, in light of the vacuum, I'm going to hand power to the military. So there's a transitional government in the military. That's effectively a coup, though, because it's not a constitutional procedure. So that's number 6. And then the next day, number 7. So they had 2 coups in less than 24 hours, maybe even less than 12 hours at that point.
As you said before, you might be able to get a discount on that.
Yeah. And, you know, then the sort of the situation since then has been this discussion about, well, okay, how do you transition from military rule to democratic rule? It's especially challenging when you have such a dysfunctional political system because of all this years of manipulation where he had his one ruling party and then 39 other parties. I mean, there's at least 40 parties. It seemed like they were growing by the day because, you know, it would be, oh, he's meeting with 20 opposition parties, or there's 30 opposition parties at this meeting, and then the next day it's 40 opposition parties. So there are over 40 political parties in Burkina Faso. Not a great recipe for kind of creating the sort of a stable environment. But they actually surprisingly managed to get together a pretty quick meeting with the help of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. They sent 3 of their presidents. I feel like that's a pretty significant move of saying this is really important to us. The president from Senegal, the president from Nigeria, and the president from Ghana were the 3. And they sort of met with the military, met with some of the stakeholders. And one of the advantages is that the Constitution, as dysfunctional as it is, actually identifies pretty clearly a lot of different interest groups, you know, worker groups, religious groups, ethnic representatives, local representatives. All these different people are outlined as having a sort of specific role in the national consensus, so to speak. And I think that's a really positive sign that they might actually be able to come up with some sort of plan. And they did announce before we were recording that they had agreed at least theoretically, to a specific transition plan. What we're looking at right now is a plan to transition to democracy, to transition to civilian rule relatively quickly, and then to democracy within a year. So they already had presidential elections scheduled for like November of 2015. So they're saying, keep to that schedule. We've got to figure out a consensus sort of technocratic civilian leadership to run things in the meantime, but we might be able to achieve a military handoff within, you know, a month or 2 months at the most, and that would be a really great sign, especially because military-led transitions to democracy have a pretty high failure rate, so the quicker you can get things back on track and have a very clear plan that everyone agrees to, the better. Obviously, right now, they've got to figure out, of the 40-some-odd different possible, you know, parties, who's going to actually be able to lead that. But, you know, that's an ongoing conversation, and I think that at the moment, it's looking relatively good. I did find it interesting, though, that ECOWAS is involved in this transition process, given that their own record is not solid. They have a record, I guess, of experience with transitions to democracy and all that, but overall, it's been a little bit dicey. I think that I checked in the last 15 years, not counting these new coups in Burkina Faso, member states in ECOWAS have had 6 coups, and those are military coups that succeeded, not counting various attempted coups or questionable transitions in like Togo. And some of the member states in ECOWAS are either in current transitions that haven't finished yet or have not actually ever transitioned out of their last time they had a coup. So I have some questions as to whether or not they're necessarily the people to lead this. But on the other hand, Senegal and Cape Verde are members that have not had these military coups. So, you know, even though Nigeria or Ghana also had presidents at this meeting, have had like dozens of coups, at least, you know, usually about 6 each. There are some countries like Senegal that have never had a coup. So,
I was gonna say,
you know,
what
mixed bag there.
I'm sure there are some, but it seems like there aren't too many African nations that haven't had a coup recently, or at least, you know, in the past several decades. So.
Yeah, in the last, you know, 15 or so years, it's been a lot of these, and definitely since even the end of the Cold War, it's actually been quite
like
a few.
Yeah, I feel like especially because, you know, whether it was the, you know, propped up regimes or, you know, backed by the Soviets or backed by the West or whatever, it seemed like there was maybe a little more stability in some of these states. Of course, they're all incredibly repressive, but
I think, I don't know if that's true, though, because I think that it actually incentivized a lot of overthrowing because you say, oh, we'll get your help
wars,
here or whatever.
You know,
yeah,
it's like Angola and you're supporting various South African death squads or whatnot, all the great things that America's done. I don't know. There are the people that buy into that sort of thing. The argument always comes down to more American influence of the world equals better. Just like that is the rule. Any negative consequences that follow from that are superseded by hegemony good. Like, it's a debate argument. It's not an actual argument about the real world. It's just debate. And, you know, there are people that, you know, that is their life. They buy into that, whatever. And I would just say to that, in what world where the United States has supported groups such as the Contra and, you know, South African death squads, you know, it's just, it's a little confusing as to, you know, that automatically good hegemony. But yeah, as you were saying, there were a fair amount of conflicts and wars surrounding, but at least it felt like there were at least a couple, you know, relatively solid regimes, whereas now it seems like it's a little more unstable.
Yeah, now one thing that I think is a great point to bring off of that, which I hadn't even thought to put in my notes for this segment, is that the Colonel Isaac Zida, who was the army spokesman and the head of the presidential guard, who is now leading this military transition and was the leader of the second coup in this transition process, received military training from the United States, including actually being in the United States to receive training. And the leader of the 2012 coup in Mali, the one where they overthrew the democratic government of Mali because they were frustrated by various things about how bad the war was going. And then that coup so destabilized Mali that it led to the entire takeover of northern Mali by Islamist militants. That gentleman who led that coup was also trained by U.S. counterterrorism forces. So there are some questions being raised there as to whether We are effectively accidentally training future coup leaders in some of these projects that are supposed to be, you know, strategically vital. And Mali, along with Burkina Faso, both considered to be vital counterterrorism partners. You know, 50 to 60% of the population of Burkina Faso is Muslim. There's also a large, you know, traditional animist population and then a large Catholic or Protestant segment. You know, so I think people set looking at that and going, hey, this is a really, you know, essentially secularized government that's been stable for a long time, at least until now, and hasn't had these problems with extremism despite all the poverty. You know, what can we learn from that? And also, can we use your military bases? I mean, that's the argument that you get from France and from the United States here. And I think it's we've got to be very careful here that we're not going down that same path that we did with the proxy wars in communism, where we essentially back up these repressive regimes on the basis that it's better to continue our alliance with them at all costs than to, you know, even if it's a military government, than to risk them falling to the commies or whatever. In this case, it's the Muslims. So, that is, I think, a potential warning sign to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting how now in the past couple years, especially with the rise of ISIS and, you know, various connected groups or, you know, Islamist groups, that we've begun in the American political lexicon when it relates to foreign policy sort of replaced this nebulous communist threat with the nebulous Islamist threat, where it never actually has to be specifically about specific groups or individuals. It's all just like a broad menace where it doesn't matter if there's a specific group or what their actual capabilities are. It's just, oh, someone somewhere might fall susceptible to, you know, these ideas. And we can't let that happen. Well, the thing is, once you start supporting, you know, these incredibly repressive regimes, even people that, you know, on their own might not have been particularly, you know, susceptible or, you know, receptive to Islamist, you know, when we talk about Islamists, we're talking about, you know, extremely hardcore, whether it's, you know, Wahhabism or whatever, they might not have, you know, engaged with that otherwise, but because there's a, you know, incredibly repressive regime and the opposition are almost entirely Islamists, you know, that's how you get drawn into maybe, I don't know, whether it's full force supporting them, you know, engaging in jihad or just having, you know, political sympathies towards them when you might not otherwise. So just that's something we need to keep into consideration, just as America's support for various repressive, quote unquote, capitalist regimes or anti-communist regimes led people to support communism. I mean, it's pretty simple.
Now, the other thing that's come up in this story is whether or not this is going to have that similar domino or contagion effect that we saw with Tunisia's example in the Arab Spring. We saw immediately on Twitter this was being labeled the Printemps Noir, which is complemented to the Printemps Arabe, the French name. You know, in Tunisia has a lot of French influence and French speaking continuing there, even though it's not an official language anymore. But, you know, saying that this is going to be the Black Spring, the sub-Saharan African Spring, you know, along the same lines as the Arab Spring in that started in Tunisia. And the reason for speculating this is that, you know, in addition to your, you know, Deby government in Chad or Afewerki government in Eritrea, those 1990-91 governments that are not going anywhere and don't really care about elections, you do have some of these other ones like Joseph Kabila's government in the DR Congo. You've got the guy, I forget his name, who came to power in... So Kabila came in 2001 when his father died. You have in neighboring, you know, former French Congo, Republic of Congo, you've got a guy in since 97. You've got Rwanda's Paul Kagame in since 2000, winning his most recent re-election with 90% of the vote. You've got, you know, Robert Mugabe on his absolute last possible legs. He's like 90 and looks like death every day. You've got the, you know, folks in Equatorial Guinea and Angola who have literally been in office since 1979. They're now the two, within a month of each other, they're now the two longest serving leaders in the world outside of, you know, a monarchy. And so this question is, are we going to see a contagion here where this starts to spread? You know, what about Cameroon, 1982? So these 1980s leaders, these, you know, early 2000s, late 1990s leaders, some of them have been toppled recently. Is this the start of a wider uprising? My guess at the moment, probably not. But I mean, I think a lot of and a lot of folks really botched the call on the Arab Spring and whether or not that would, you know, lead to the government of Egypt being overthrown, for example. And so I wonder if it's actually possible to predict these kind of contagion effects anymore.
I would say it's probably more difficult, and this is like, you know, very theoretical and like tough to really back up. But I sometimes wonder if there's maybe a stronger connection between, you know, we talk about how Arab Spring sort of started in Tunisia and sort of spread across, you know, North Africa and into the Middle East. And sometimes I wonder if maybe there's more connection between the political events in many of these Muslim countries or, you know, countries in that region of the world than there might be between, you know, various countries in sub-Saharan Africa, just because, I don't know, whether the particulars on the ground are very different and you have just like these incredibly diverse countries with, you know, various ethnic groups and various different complaints about the regime, or maybe there was maybe more similarities in the North. See, this is like difficult to back up with any specifics or like any concrete examples of why that is, but that just may be my thought of potentially the differences.
I think you're on the right track there. I mean, I think that you've got the, you know, in some of these countries, multiple native languages and native ethnicities, and then even across countries within the sort of colonial framework, you've right. got the French-speaking countries.
Yeah, because you have all that to deal
you know,
with
the,
as well.
The English-speaking countries, all that. So, you know, I think that there's a risk of oversimplifying in a way that, you know, I think you're on the right track there. The Arab countries, you know, they're not uniform by any means either,
no.
but they've got that shared ethnicity, that shared language, that shared, you know, history of sweeping conquest.
Right. And when you talk about the things. Arab street, that is like people exaggerate that, but that is maybe more a thing than you would say the sub-Saharan Africa street, because
right.
you've got about 50 different countries and they all have very different particulars, so might be a little bit different than, like, you know, the 5-6 countries that are, you know, suffering under similar authoritarian repressive regimes and all have a similar language, and many of which I would say probably communicate on social media to a large degree. Not that saying that doesn't happen in sub-Saharan Africa, but there's like a broader sort of interconnectedness between some of these Muslim countries, and especially once everything started, it was almost like a snowball effect where, you know, from one country to the other, things started to, you know, take on similar forms. So, you know, whether that's Twitter, whether that's, you know, various YouTube videos, things like that, it's tough to say. But I mean, I would like to see if there are, you know, democratic movements in some of these repressive sub-Saharan African countries, it would be very encouraging to see, you know, some of the similar things start to spread. I don't know if it'll be exactly like the Arab Spring, but, you know, one would hope that the democratic movement will continue for many of the same reasons that we saw during the Arab Spring. It might not be as fast or as connected, but, you know, there's no reason why what a democratic movement in one country can't affect another democratic movement in another country, even across the continent, you know. So Africa is a huge place, but there's also a lot of connectedness between it as well.
Right. It's some level of shared experiences, certainly. All right. Well, Nate, I want to thank you so much for being here with me today on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.